From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. The latest report from the Labor Department dropped unemployment down a notch, one percentage point. But the new numbers also showed that teen unemployment is still on the rise. It's now at 25%. And here in the nation's capital, that rate is much higher. At almost 50% this summer, it's the highest in the country. NPR's Hansi Lo Wong spoke with unemployed teens in Washington, D.C.
16-year-old Jaquan Clark would have liked a job this summer, but he says the competition is brutal.
It's like crabs in a barrel, you know, like we're trying to all get jobs, but we're also pulling each other back because we want the jobs and our friends need it, we need it.
He applied for jobs through Washington, D.C.'s Summer Youth Employment Program, which pays local teens to work in government agencies and local businesses. This summer, the government-funded program placed 14,000 D.C. teens in jobs, but Clark didn't make the cut. And that could affect his whole future.
I'm going to my senior year, so it's like, how am I supposed to, like, help gather the extra money to go to college?
Clark's been volunteering in a youth theater program this summer, earning experience but no pay. His father is a public safety officer at a D.C. university and the only full-time income earner in their family of four. With no summer income, Clark says he's worried about paying for college application fees this fall. Michael Saltzman is a research fellow at the business-backed Employment Policies Institute, and he says teens like Jaquan Clark have been facing a new norm for the summer job search ever since the recession began.
Someone that started as a freshman back in, say, 2007 has never known anything other than a job market where they look for work for weeks and haven't been able to find something.
According to last month's jobs report, the national teen unemployment rate is about 25%. Saltzman says the last time teen unemployment ticked above 20% was in 1981, but the rate fell below that level just over 2 years later. This summer, teens around the country have faced the third summer in a row of teen unemployment above 20%, and Saltzman says this trend is likely to continue.
It's tempting to look at the teen unemployment rate and sort of shrug and assume that it's bad, but the only consequence is that maybe the parents are giving them money to go out to the movies this summer instead of the kids earning the money themselves.
But working a summer job as a teen is not just about earning extra spending money. Saltzman says it's also about learning skills so you can become a good worker later in your adult life.
The risk is that if they miss out on that they become part of this lost generation of teens who never had a chance to get a foothold to take that first step on the career ladder and do something greater.
Studies showed the discouraged teenage job seeker can grow up to become a discouraged adult worker who's more likely to be underpaid and even unemployed.
I feel like there are so many young adults and young people who don't want to try to get jobs because they've been turned down so many times.
19-year-old LaQuisha Barnes lives in Washington, D.C. She says she applied to supermarkets and clothing stores but didn't land a summer job, so she decided to volunteer instead. But Barnes says some of her friends are wasting away their summers.
I know, like, my friend isn't working, and she sits at home and does nothing all day but watch TV and, like, CSI and stuff like that. And I wish there were more opportunities, especially for young people.
Opportunities like this youth-produced musical Barnes and Jaquan Clark have been working on since June.
I'm gonna win! Don't count me out!
LaQuisha Barnes is one of the cast members in the musical, and she says she may not be working this summer, but she doesn't plan on being counted out in the future. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News, Washington.
I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, we'll talk about the perks the millennial generation wants on the job and how employers are working to meet them halfway. But first, you've been telling your friends not to post those silly photos of themselves clutching brimming beer mugs or worse, posting angry or threatening status updates. Now that may be coming back to haunt them, thanks to the Social Intelligence Corporation. The company searches everything you've done publicly online for the past 7 years and reports back to prospective employers. But will the increasingly blurred lines between saying our social and work lives end up costing you a job? To talk about the rising use of social media background checks, we invited Max Drucker, CEO and co-founder of Social Intelligence Corporation, and John Verdi, the Senior Counsel for the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Great to be here.
So, Max, let me start with you. If you've got the skills, you're qualified for the job, you're not doing anything illegal, why does it matter what you're doing on Facebook or Twitter or whatever?
Well, Social Intelligence Corp only looks for employer predefined criteria. And that criteria is racist remarks, potentially violent behavior, illegal activities such as drug use, and sexually explicit material. We do not look or report on anything else, so that job applicant really is able to have a robust and strong online presence without fearing being discriminated against based on some post of them drinking beer, or even worse, something that such as them being a single mom and that coming back to haunt them because an employer made a hiring decision illegally based on that information.
So what kind of activities do you look at and where do you look for them?
We look both on the major social networks, but we also look broader to the message boards, to comments on news articles, to the photo and video sharing sites. And we are looking for very specific things. We are looking for people that make blatantly racist statements. We are looking for people that are flagrantly displaying a weapon, an assault rifle, pointing it at the camera.
Wait, let me ask you a question, though. I mean, because assault rifles are legal in some places, so why is that a problem?
Well, the employer has the right, and the employer chooses what we are to look for. And if an employer is not concerned about that, we don't identify it. To answer the question about why this may be relevant, that's up to the employer. But an argument they may make is, well, this isn't illegal, and this is their right to do. They may not feel that a person is representing them the way that company would want them to represent themselves publicly.
John, let me bring you into the conversation, because the idea of poring over someone's internet footprint can be alarming to some privacy advocates. But if it's stuff that you have publicly put out there yourself, why is it a privacy issue?
Well, I think it is alarming. I think the reality is that these sorts of social media background checks are here to stay, regardless of whether it's social intelligence, whether it's employers doing this work themselves, or whether it's another service. So the reason why one might be concerned about this sort of social background check is that many social profiles on Facebook, Google+, Twitter, are necessarily incomplete. Individuals use their privacy settings to reveal some information to the public and to not reveal other information to the public.
Right.
To take your example of an individual with an assault rifle, if you were to take a photograph of an individual with an assault rifle and you take that photograph out of context and you put it in a background check report, what you don't learn is that that individual was recently discharged from the Marine Corps, that that photograph was taken while they were stationed overseas in Iraq. And the employer has no way to know that, nor does social intelligence have any way to know that, unless the individual has revealed other information about themselves beyond the photograph on a social networking site. So context is important.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with John Verdi, Senior Counsel for the Electronic Privacy Information Center. I'm also joined by Max Drucker, CEO and co-founder of Social Intelligence Corporation. Let me ask you both a question. Just a couple of years back, anything that you did outside of the workplace pretty much wasn't your boss's business, right? But if you go to pulling people's comments on news stories and checking into whether somebody tried to buy a car or something on Craigslist, that might strike some as a pretty extreme intrusion into your personal life. I mean, it's kind of, as one commentator I saw suggested, like having your boss send someone to the bar you're at, listen to your conversation, and then come back and tell your boss what you said. I mean, John, isn't that kind of like being on the clock 24/7, everything you do and say?
Well, yeah, the legal considerations aside, there's a real human question to ask here. And the question that we need to ask is, do we want to put vastly more information about employees and job applicants' private lives in front of their employers or prospective employers? And do we want that information to have any kind of relevancy guarantees concerning their employment status, concerning their job description? That's a question that we as a society need to ask ourselves. How much privacy are we willing to give up and put in the hands of our employers who, let's be honest, control our paycheck?
Max, explain why it's okay for a boss to have that level of control over what the employee is doing.
Employers are in a really tough spot in the age of social media. If they're one of the 80% of employers that are doing the internet screen themselves, they are exposing themselves to all kinds of things that aren't legally allowable or frankly not relevant, and thus are violating that job applicant's privacy. But on the other hand, they have an obligation to protect their existing employees against major risks, which really fall into the same categories as why they do the traditional screens, such as criminal and drug. The way we solve this problem is by only identifying predefined criteria and ignore everything else.
Let me ask you, Max, does your company do ongoing monitoring of people or just the one-time background check?
We do ongoing monitoring, but purely to the specifications of enforcing a company's social media policy.
So how is that not basically having somebody standing over said person's shoulder every time they're at the computer?
Well, most corporations or many corporations monitor activity on their internet use and on their computers. But a company has the right to have a social media policy, and that's part of their employee handbook.
John, what kind of different privacy concerns does ongoing monitoring offer, if any?
One of the major risks is that companies' social media policies are often illegally overbroad. There was one example recently in the state of Connecticut where an ambulance worker took to the social media site to complain about her boss, who she believed was endangering workplace safety with some of the decisions that he was making on the job. Now, that sort of speech is actually protected under the National Labor Relations Act. Employees are entitled to talk about workplace safety concerns without penalty and without reprisal. However, she was fired from her job, and the National Labor Relations Board had to intervene. All of those actions by the company were consistent with its social media policy. And that company's social media policy was no employee may post anything on social media about the company.
Let me ask a final question to you both. First, John, if you've got stuff out there that you shouldn't have out there, do you just take it down or do you try and find a way to explain that when you go into the job interview in the first place and try and avoid this? And Max, I want you to answer it after John does.
Well, I think everybody has the right to pull down information that they previously have shared on social media sites. And if someone is going into a job search, I think that they would be wise to do a self-assessment on their social media profile. As to explaining it, I think context is critical. And the real question is whether or not individuals are going to be given a meaningful opportunity to provide that context within the job search.
Max, same question to you. And again, you're going back into 7 years of data, so explain how much saving here people have an opportunity to do.
Well, we can use anything that goes back 7 years, but everything we're still looking at is publicly available. It's what's out there right now. And yes, I totally agree with John. You should do some sort of self-assessment. But I'm also a major advocate that a person can have a very strong online profile and a positive one. And social intelligence also identifies very specific positive criteria for those reports and redacts anything, again, that's not legally allowable.
All right. I've got to leave it there, gentlemen. Max Drucker is co-founder and CEO of Social Intelligence Corporation. He joined us from Santa Barbara, California. John Verdi is senior counsel of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. He joined us from our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you, gentlemen, both for a spirited conversation.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's been a lot of talk lately about millennials. Who are they and what do they want? There are more than 40 million people in America who are in their 20s, and this generation of workers is on pace to be the most educated yet. But the latest labor statistics show that the 20-somethings are having a little trouble finding jobs. Their unemployment rate is about 12% for 18 to 29-year-olds, a bit higher than the nation's current 9.2% rate. What complicates the issue even more is that as these young people enter the workplace, there's a big gap between their expectations and those of potential employers. In other words, they want a few perks here and there. Joining us to talk about millennials in the job market is Ryan Healy. He's the chief operating officer and co-founder of Brazen Careerist, a website designed to help young professionals. And he's sitting right here with us in our studios. Hey, Ryan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So for those of us that aren't clear, are millennials and Generation Y the same thing?
Yeah, same thing. So the oldest Gen Yers or oldest millennials were the high school graduating class of the year 2000. So that's where the name millennials came from, the new millennium. So
high school graduating.
High school graduating
2000.
Class of 2000.
2000.
I still can't say we. Talk to us a little bit about the expectations gap between millennial workers and their bosses.
You know, I think millennials in general are looking for something that they can come into where they're going to learn a lot. They're going to grow personally and professionally, and they're really going to get a lot out of it. To help them advance in their career somewhere else. And that somewhere else may not be at the same job. So what you see is millennials hopping jobs every 18 months on average. And, you know, bosses in general are looking for people to stick around for 5 or 10 years. And that doesn't happen anymore with people in their 20s as they're trying to figure things out.
So the thing that my parents told you was get a job, stick with it, be there for 30 years. You guys don't have to do that.
Yeah, that doesn't work. And, you know, I think millennials realize there's a danger in that because you never know when you're going to get laid off or fired. And sticking with something for 30 years, you're giving them control rather than you having control.
Is that fear partly because the economy's been so iffy the last few years, or is it kind of the way you guys were brought up with the whole, you guys are great. No, you're great. Everybody gets a trophy. You can negotiate for your ace. You're not kind of used to the adversarial. You've got to sit in a cubicle.
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, it was, you know, this is a generation of people who grew up with their parents saying you can do anything you want to do, you can be anything you want to be, and they listen to it. So they don't want to settle for something where they're sitting in a cubicle and not able to innovate and have a voice in things. But also the economy, you know, it's definitely had an effect on it. They've seen people get laid off. They know it can happen. And they know that ultimately the safest thing you can do is have control of your own career, not put that control in someone else's hand.
But I would think everyone wants a fun place to work and a place that inspires you and makes you happy to be there. So why would it work for this generation when it doesn't seem to have worked all that well for some of the previous generations?
It's interesting. It's a demographics thing, really. And if you look at generations, Generation X, who's the generation before millennials or Gen Y, is 50 million people. The baby boomers were about 76 million.
Okay, wait. Generation X came out of high school around when?
Let's see. They probably came out of high school in the 80s.
Gasp.
80s and early 90s.
Gasp.
Yeah. Exactly.
Tottering around now.
Yeah, so, but it's a very small generation, comparatively. So they weren't able to have as much of a voice or make any kind of changes because there weren't that many of them. And with Gen Y, it's a much larger generation and they're able to find different jobs because companies need to fill those jobs.
A lot of 20-somethings today seem to be putting off some of the things that, again, Gen X or worse, older than that, the baby boomers might have thought were things you do. You get out of college, you get married, you have some babies, you get a mortgage. But again, not so much a focus for the millennials.
Yeah, you know, people are putting it off. Marriage is delayed. Kids are delayed. It's partly because people are living longer. And, you know, really what's happening is people are graduating college and they're in this almost delayed adulthood or emerging adulthood where they're trying to really figure out what it is they want to do with their lives. And they don't have a mortgage to pay and they don't have kids to feed. So they can afford to do that because they're only feeding themselves ultimately, and you can afford to take the lower paying job or go babysit and bartend instead of taking the job in the cubicle that you just don't want.
Sounds like a lot of roommate situations going on out there.
Oh, yeah. If you look in D.C., everybody has a roommate because it's too expensive to live on your own.
Yes. If you're just tuning in, I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the challenges for the millennial generation entering the workforce now. Our guest is Ryan Healy. He's co-founder of Brazen Careerist, a site for young professionals. What do you say to those who kind of call millennials Generation Y-ers lazy, entitled people who just are too big for their britches, basically?
You know, I mean, there's some merit to it. You could say that people wanting to have a job that's interesting, that where they can learn, where they can have flexible hours, might be entitled. But really, it's something that they want because they want to have a high quality of life. And, you know, I think ultimately everyone wants that. Gen Y is making their voices heard a little bit more, and that can lead to some controversy.
I'm wondering, since your unemployment is a little bit higher than average, are bosses not going for that kind of entitledness?
You know, that's a good question. I don't have all the answers on that, but I do think that there are a lot of folks who are actually deciding not to take that job that they're not really interested in, and instead searching for that job that they really want and putting it off. And, you know, often a lot of times people go live at home with their parents so they can delay taking that job that they just really don't want until they find that great one. And that may have something to do with it, but, you know, there is a higher unemployment rate, but a lot of the employers that we're talking with at Brazen Careerist are looking for highly educated, smart, young people, and they're looking for them to come in management positions pretty early.
But what about long-established companies? If they're not used to those kinds of demands from workers, are they passing over millennials and going for the Generation X's or the baby boomers who are less
a sea change for their whole operation?
You know, they're really looking to figure out how they can recruit and engage with these folks who are in Generation Y. They realize that it's just sheer numbers, right? There's so many people that are this age, and there's so few people who are that age in between that they have to go out and they have to adapt their business practices and work with these folks to bring them on. So the established companies are really the ones who are having this conversation the most.
Talk to us about some of the strengths that your generation brings into the workplace. Are you guys better able to deal with diversity, race, gender, sexual orientation? You're not like, eek.
Definitely. I mean, there's a huge sense of diversity with Generation Y. I grew up like it. You know, you see... I think in the workplace, the Latino population by 2050 is going to be 30% of the workplace, up from 15%. You know, I think some other strengths are people that really want to get things done, results-oriented, you know, let's finish this, let's get it done, and let's be on with it. And that can be a good thing. It could also be a bad thing. Sometimes you need to strategize, think through, edit things, pay a little more attention. But in general, it's a sense of let's get this done, let's get on to the next thing, and let's move quickly.
So... what is it that a company has to do to attract and keep a millennial for more than, you know, 3 months or so?
Yeah, I think it's really about relationship building. Figure out how you can make these Gen Yers friends with the other people in the company, because people tend to stick around a company where they have friends at that company. And really, as 20-somethings who are social, just out of college, not necessarily with a family, they want to go out and have fun after work, and they want to do it with their friends, and they'd much prefer to be in an office where they can hang out with somebody at lunch and really build strong relationships.
Ryan Healy is the co-founder and chief operating officer of Brazen Careerist. It's a site designed to help young professionals and college students find work. He joined us in our studios in Washington, D.C. today. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
I want some yoga. Coming up, fans swoon over Shirley Strawberry's tips for solving relationship problems, but she says her most important bond is with her daughter.
Kids mimic what you do more than what you say, so I want to be that example for her. Even more than for myself, I want to show her.
Radio personality Shirley Strawberry on her new book, The Strawberry Letter. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes.
This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Unless you've been in a cave for the past week or so, you may just have heard something about Congress and legislation to adjust the nation's debt ceiling. And while the legislation was passed and quickly signed by President Obama to prevent damage to the nation's credit rating, many of the details involved were left for later, cuts to be identified by a super committee at a later date. Joining me now to talk about what all this might mean for environmental and energy issues is Alana Shore. She's a staff reporter at the Energy and Environmental Daily at Green and the Greenwire, and she's been keeping tabs in Congress. Welcome to Science Friday, Alana.
Thanks for having me.
What in the recent debt ceiling bill affects the environment?
Well, the word environment, and for that matter, energy, isn't mentioned, Ira, but what is set are targets for discretionary spending. Now, these are the types of programs, not just energy and environment, but education, housing, basically anything that's not entitlements or the military. And what it promises is huge cuts across the board, below even the levels that we saw back in April when the government nearly shut down and billions were cut.
Mm-hmm. So we don't really know then what kinds of things might be cut.
Well, I mean, one of the first targets, lawmakers are already saying this, are grants that are given to states and localities to clean up their water supplies. This took a $100 million hit plus in the April deal, and House Republicans are eyeing it already. It's fairly easy, unfortunately, to cut grants that go out the door because, you know, states need them. There's no member of Congress that's mm-hmm. going to fight for them.
Mm-hmm. Going into this battle, there was an emphasis from the Democratic side about ending subsidies for oil and gas production and oil industry tax breaks. Did any of those plans make the final bill?
Unfortunately, not. Because, frankly, the oil industry made a very strong case for keeping its economic benefits. The fact that other industries you know, receive similar tax deductions. And part of that unfortunate factor there is that ethanol also got its subsidies taken off the table, even though the industry was saying we're ready to get rid of them. Mm-hmm. So there was a real lack of interest in considering revenue of any kind.
Was it what were regulations for pollutants affected or attached or onto this bill at the last moment?
They were not. This bill was kept relatively clean of any kind of last-minute, you know, policy prescriptions. But that said, the super committee may well put that back on the table. They have a pretty broad mandate, anything that can be shown to save the government money.
Mm-hmm. So it'll be up to the super committee to decide what might be they might see as the low-hanging fruit, so to speak, that's left in this kind of legislation.
Exactly. And, you know, that could and one has to kind of almost assume it'll include energy and environmental program cuts. Now, and we haven't even gotten to what happens, Ira, if the super committee can't come to an agreement or if what they do suggest is shot down by Congress, because then you have a what's called a sequestration where there's across the board cuts from all these programs again. Of more than $1 trillion over 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts that maybe there might be less money for the EPA? I know Congress, their members of Congress are not very happy with the EPA. Might they try to cut some money out of that, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, those grants that I mentioned earlier for safe drinking water and for wastewater treatment go through EPA. And there are plenty of other EPA programs that are already preparing to deal with some really, really lean years. You know, when the president went on television and said these spending levels haven't been seen since the Eisenhower era, you hear a lot of environmentalists, you know, clutching their heart and saying, well, that was before the Clean Air Act, so if we don't have money to enforce that, uh-oh.
Yeah.
It's kind of the sentiment.
Speaking of the Clean Air Act, what about other bills that might be in jeopardy here or bills that might come up to put environmental legislation or environmental regulations or energy in jeopardy? For example, there are a lot of energy subsidies to help alternative energies out now to help them develop a market. Or might they be in jeopardy?
They very well might be. You know, Democrats are pretty eager to get those oil and gas benefits back in the mix for the super committee. But if that happens, one has to expect that Republicans will say, well, what about the subsidies going to solar and wind?
Right.
And that is almost bound to happen soon because this committee, Ira, has to make its recommendations by Thanksgiving, which is not too far off in congressional time.
And they're on vacation now.
Right? Yes, they are.
Yes. All right. Ilana, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you.
Good luck to you. Ilana Shore is a staff reporter at the Energy Environment Daily and Greenwire.